from deep inside your radio.
I just felt we needed something to say the show's beginning. You know, we have no funding credits and no producing organization saying we did it. So there you go. Now you know the show's beginning. More importantly, I know the show's beginning because I'm tired. So, ladies and gentlemen, a couple of things just right here, right at the what we now recognize universally to be the outset of the broadcast. Danny Pearl, Daniel Pearl, I prefer to call him, because I don't know him. I didn't know him. You know who he was. He was the Wall Street Journal East Asia bureau chief who was working in Pakistan when he was kidnapped and murdered, brutally murdered, evidence submitted via videotape, which, yeah, we know it'll surface. We know that. But I just want to address the whole Danny Pearl deal. Because if you've been watching television, you've seen all these newsies sitting in Washington and New York talking about Danny Pearl, like he was their drinking buddy. I mean, you know, a couple of people at the Wall Street Journal actually did know him, played basketball with him, they said. Okay, fine. But $7 million anchors sitting in the green room have about as much in common with Daniel Pearl poking around the outer fringes of the bad stuff in Pakistan as I do with Kobe Bryant. Yeah, we both play basketball. That's right. But it's a different kind of game. So, you know, I have nothing but sympathy for the family of Mr. Pearl and for his fellow workers. But spare me all the guilty media guys going on about Danny Pearl as if they would know how to do his job. As if Larry King, I'm not picking on you, Larry, or Katie Couric, or Tom, or Dan, or Pete, would know how to do what Daniel Pearl did. So just, you know, that, there's that. Like, I know how to do what Kobe does. I know how to do it. I just can't do it. And then, ladies and gentlemen, the Mencken Watch continues. This week, on Thursday night, the estimable Fox Network counter-programmed the Winter Olympics with the Glutton Bowl, in which people ate a lot of stuff, a lot of disgusting stuff. H.M. Mencken told us, some variant of nobody ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American public. NBC scored record-breaking or record-tying or record-shattering or record-playing ratings Thursday night for the Winter Olympics, smothering the Glutton Bowl. Mencken's wrong again. Hello. Welcome to the show.
Roll it, you can squeeze it. you three times a seven to know what you wanna do.
Coffee, I love tea. I love the Java Jive and it loves me. Coffee and tea and the jiving in me. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, boy.
I love Java, sweet and hot. Whoops, Mr. Mercer, I'm a coffee pot. Shoot me the pot and I'll pour me a shot.
A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup,
boy.
Slip me a slug from that wonderful mug, and I'll cut, cut a rug till I'm snug in the jug. A slice of onion on a raw one.
Draw one. Waiter, waiter, percolator.
I love coffee, I love tea. I love the Java Jive, but recently been losing my dough and a dollar a throw. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, boy. Boston bean, soybean, lima bean, string bean. I'm not keen for a bean
unless it is a cheery beery coffee bean.
I love coffee, I love tea. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, boy. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, boy. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, boy. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup.
E voltarei, eu sou meu guia. milk.
Parto com a lua derramada no espelho do mar. Cartas de um futuro, tem um mundo pra se revelar. Era o outro lado do sol e um perfume de fruta e de flor. Roda minha vida nas trapaças do Criador. E eu irei em qualquer direção e voltarei. Eu sou meu guia. Eu sou meu guia. Quando o sol vem brilhar e um resto de estrela da noite clareia amanhã, terra e sol, vento e mar, o segredo que eu trago guardado no meu talismã, no meu talismã, no meu talismã.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to yet and still another edition of the show, despite everything, really. Despite it all. Here it is. Here it is, still. Boy, what a lot of stuff to talk about today, because you've been busy, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, let's catch up on the Olympics, just cleaning up after the Olympics. Apropos of that. How about that beer riot? Last week on the broadcast, I talked about kind of bragging on New Orleans, how they don't let commercial sponsorship into the Mardi Gras. And I made particular note of beers. A correspondent from New Orleans clarifies they do allow the Clydesdales in a couple of parades, but they're not allowed to be identified as belonging to a brewery. So they could just be, you know, Ed McMahon's friends. But they don't allow a big Budweiser tent at Mardi Gras where kids can go in and cause a riot like they did in Salt Lake City over the weekend. A Salt Lake City beer riot. It confirms everything the Mormons have ever thought about alcohol, I'm afraid. Or at least Budweiser. People will riot for Budweiser. Isn't that wild? Also, the French judge at the center of that figure skating judging controversy, that cause célèbre, says from the moment she was named as an Olympic judge, she was the target of an extraordinary lobbying effort by Canada. I have warned, ladies and gentlemen, I have warned you about Canada for years, long before South Park. I have warned, I said, why are we having, why is one third of our anchor triumvirate occupied by a Canadian? Well, this tells you what the Canadians are like. Marie Reine Lagune said the pressure she felt was unlike anything in her 14 years of judging, and it came from only Canada. It intensified as the Olympics drew near. This is a change from her original story, but this was during a two-hour interview conducted en anglais, s'il vous plaît, in her lawyer's office in Salt Lake City. It was her most extensive public explanation of events. Her account was not independently verifiable. Two high-ranking Western figure skating officials, under the cloak of anonymity, exercising the triple axle of anonymity, say they believe her version of events. A senior Canadian official poo-pooed it. "I have no reason to believe Canada is involved," says Michael Chambers, president of the Canadian Olympic Association. "Nothing leads me to believe that it's true." Lagoon said the lobbying effort was led by senior skating officials from Canada and at least one powerful official on the skating union with ties to Canada. Who knew skaters had a union? No, it's not that kind of... She had nowhere to turn for help, she said. Many of those lobbying her were the same people who control the careers of judges and influence their assent to important international committees. "That is why all judges are so scared," she says. "I was trapped." That's the fun of figure skating. That's a fun world of figure skating, ladies and gentlemen, into which Sarah Hughes just skated. But there's more. There's more about the Olympics. Because it didn't just happen. This all didn't just happen, ladies and gentlemen. The genesis of the United States' success in winning gold medals and all medals in Salt Lake City, all kinds of medals in Salt Lake City, was our abysmal six-medal showing at the 1988 Winter Games in Calgary, according to the Washington Post. In response to that humiliation, a special panel chaired by, get this, New York Yankee owner George Steinbrenner issued a report in 1989 stating the United States' sole Olympic mission should be winning medals. Winning is not everything, it's the only thing. He went Vince on us. And warning, it wouldn't come cheap. The panel urged the United States Olympic Committee to spend more on Olympians, underwriting their training, helping with basic living expenses, and extending their Olympic careers instead of having to give up sports for jobs. In the 4 years leading up to Salt Lake, the United States Olympic Committee doubled its investment in athletes, $40 million compared to $20 million previously. Nearly half of that went to the podium program, funneling money to sports and athletes identified as having the best chance of winning medals. Picking winners, in other words. Top-ranked American speed skaters received monthly stipends to make it easier to train full-time, including Apollo Anton Ono. You don't name a kid that if you aren't already planning for him to be in the Olympics. Really. You don't see a guy, you know, at the orientation for bank tellers with, "Hello, my name is Apollo Ono" on it. You don't. I swear to you, you don't. Members of the women's hockey team also got monthly stipends, as well as money to pay their coach and sports psychologist. I said sports psychologist. The United States Olympic Committee also increased the bonuses promised to amateur athletes who won medals. $25,000 bonuses for winning gold, $15,000 for silver, $10,000 for bronze. Can we stop this already now, please? Can we stop this? We know what it is. And that poor judge, she was trapped by the Canadians. All right, well, we haven't heard enough about Ken Lay this week. How about this? The mystery buyer of former Enron chairman Kenneth Lay's Aspen vacation home went public this week, announcing his $10 million purchase in a brief statement issued from the Hollywood set of the soap opera The Bold and the Beautiful. Bradley Bell! From The Bold and Beautiful. Bing would love him. Bradley Bell, executive producer of the popular soap opera, and his wife, Bing, describe themselves as very low-key and private people who would like to keep it that way, despite paying a record price for the Lay family's secluded getaway home, to which they can now no longer get away. He's the head writer for the series, declining to be interviewed, but through the show's publicist, he said he had no immediate plans for the property other than using it as a personal residence. No hidden agenda, according to his spokesman, Mr. Bell. Mr. Bell does not know Mr. Lay, and has no ties to the Enron Corporation. The Bold and Beautiful was created by Bradley Bell's parents, Bill Bell and Lee Philip Bell. They also created The Young and the Restless. Wow. fecund folks. And better news about Enron than even that. Speaking of Enron and show business, was Bradley... No, he wasn't involved in this. This was Houston-based show business by Enron. I don't know if you know this story. Enron designed and maintained a fake trading floor on the sixth floor of its Houston headquarters. According to former employees, this was a set designed to trick financial analysts into believing that the energy trading business was booming. Potemkin trading floor, yes indeed. It was an elaborate Hollywood production that we went through every year when the analysts were going to be there to impress them to make our stock go up, according to former employee Carol Elkin. She worked for Enron for 5 years. She was once even commended by Jeffrey I-don't-know-nothing Skilling. Elkin said the phony trading room was staffed by her and other employees to resemble a real trading operation. They would build out the sixth floor in what I called a Hollywood set. They would build out a set with big 36-inch flat paneled screens and teleconference conference rooms. It was all an act. No trades were actually made there. The people on the phones were talking to each other. They would ask us to go alternately in like hour shifts down to the sixth floor and sit and pretend that we lived and worked there, said Elkin. Elkin said it fit the company's culture that Enron couldn't just be a good company. It had to appear to be the best, even if it was make-believe. It was absurd that we were doing this, Elkin said. But to me, she adds, the most absurd part was that it worked. Up to a point. Did Enron have any comment about the fake trading floor? It did not. And now our regular feature, ladies and gentlemen.
We're so sorry.
Whoa, my goodness. We're all sorry. I don't know how that happened, and I don't care. Dateline Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. A supermarket advertised a sale on fried chicken in honor of Black History Month. Yes, it's true. The Associated Press reported this. I'm not making this up. Prompting the company to issue an apology after a customer complained. Giant Food Store's customer Lance Sellers brought the ad to the attention of the manager of the store. The sign read, in honor of Black History Month, we at Giant are offering a special savings on fried chicken. Now, first of all, savings is a plural and is a singular. But he wasn't complaining about that. I showed it to a few of the other customers and they were all stunned, said Lance Sellers. When I approached the store manager, he had the nerve to ask me why it offended me so much. Giant Food Stores apologized this week and said the sign was not meant to be offensive. Sellers said the sign wouldn't keep him from shopping at the store. Because those prices are so darn... The British military apologized this week for an embarrassing invasion of Spain over the weekend. 20 more Royal Marines, according to the Associated Press, about 20 Marines. Hello? Can you verify that, please? About 20? 20. Went slightly off course in an amphibious exercise and stormed a Spanish beach a week ago near Gibraltar. Spanish news reports said the soldiers left after several Gibraltarian fishermen told them they were on Spanish soil. The British spokesman, who could not be identified, said the regrettable and embarrassing error lasted no more than 5 minutes. And Russia's oldest symphony orchestra has apologized to United Airlines after its musicians were thrown off a flight following an alleged bout of drunken behavior. Some 100 members of the St. Petersburg Philharmonic. Hey, St. Pete! Were removed from the plane in Washington during a routine stop in an Amsterdam to L.A. flight. The musicians had to spend the night in Washington. Ooh, hope they didn't have to see the Capitol steps. And continue their journey the following day. In a statement, the orchestra apologized. That would be the punishment, really. In a statement, the orchestra apologized. Of course, if they were drunk, they might think it was fun. In a statement, the orchestra apologized to the pilot, the crew, and the passengers for our unpardonable conduct. The statement was obtained by the New York office of the Russian news agency Itar-Tass. They were causing quite a disturbance to other passengers on the flight through their rowdiness and inebriation. Where did they think they were? Salt Lake City? Where did they think they were? The Bud Tent? This is the sort of thing you expect from a heavy metal band, not a philharmonic orchestra, said an official of United. The intervening 24 hours resulted in having brought a lot of clarity for them, according to their spokeswoman. The flight was concluded without incident. The problems began after orchestra members produced bottles they had carried on board with them. They were at the beginning of a month-long tour of the United States. And they're very sorry. Some mistakes that have not yet been apologized for, ladies and gentlemen. The United States Postal Inspection Service is investigating this. Some 50 envelopes addressed to America's Fund for Afghan Children have ended up in a gutter. The envelopes were found by somebody who called the White House. They were torn. Many had checks, notes, and photos from American children whom President Bush had asked to donate $1 to help the kids in Afghanistan. The money was gone. A Pakistani journalist who covers Islamic militants and had earlier received word that a compact disc might be the original source of the videotape of Daniel Pearl's execution had informed the FBI of all of this, but in what some officials describe as a possible blunder, no effort was made to keep track of that informer, making it impossible to trace whoever provided the tape. No apology for that yet, as far as we know. What else we got? I'm telling you, we got so much. The Pentagon now is backing away from its story that the Office of Strategic Influence was going to conduct black ops. But nobody's backed away from this yet. U.S. troops in the southern Philippines are being taught how to behave so as not to offend the locals. 30 elite U.S. commandos. Doesn't this sound like a movie? 30 elite U.S. commandos have already attended a crash course in cultural sensitivity. The presence of the U.S. troops has angered nationalist Filipinos. They say the exercises infringe on the sovereignty of the Philippines. The culture lessons are intended to address some of that bad feeling. The course, run by Ateneo de Zamboanga University, is called Gentle Wind. It's not quite a quiet storm, soft and warm, but it's Gentle Wind, which is almost as good. Gentle Wind. Pardon me. It's just basic do's and don'ts so they will not land in conflict with the communities where they're going, according to one of the course tutors, Professor Marievic Montano, said that to the BBC. For example, respect their place of worship. The region in which the soldiers are operating is mainly Muslim, though the Philippines as a whole is mainly Christian. The soldiers have been told to be especially sensitive towards women, to refrain from bad language and flirting. Now they tell them. Because that works in this country, right? Well, flirting does, but public displays of affection are definitely out. Because most of our people are conservative, said Professor Montano, and if they see this, they feel scandalized. However, she admitted there was nothing to stop the soldiers from visiting local brothels if they wanted to. Oh, that conservative they're not. They got brothels. She says on that subject, I don't know whether we can really contain them. She said her pupils had been very responsive to her lessons. Some of them felt this actually helped them a lot. So, kudos and thanks. And maybe we can all join our elite commandos in learning something from Gentle Wind.
It's not like I'm a lame ass beside or a loser cub. It's just that I am buried deep inside the CD's box.
But
hidden bonus track,
not
listed on the album cover. Not listed on the jukebox. I'm hiding like a secret lover, and your patience is the key to my loss. Not everybody's gonna find me. Not everybody's gonna care. Like borders in your sofa cushions. Unless you look, you'll never know that I'm there. You gotta listen closely. Stupid drunken outtakes, or an alternative mix, or the whole band switches instruments and takes a crack.
track number six. Ode to an animate object. Unfunny inside jokes. Ad libs and off key warbling. Stuff that doesn't rhyme. Best thing on the album. Last thing on your mind. In this song, no one will ever hear about it, cause all the track IDs are wrong. Only a fan will find me, only a fan will care.
Hidden Mother's Track.
You know, I'm not like a troll under a bridge, you know. I'm not like some ogre at the end of a record, you know. I'd like my song to be heard just once, maybe. Maybe we could put on the jewel case bonus tracks. You know, sometimes you do that, you know. I'm not some, like, leper back here, you know, with my skin falling off. You know, it's just a damn song, okay? So just put it on.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is Book Bag. Book Bag, chit and chat about the fascinating world between the covers. I'm Ira Zipkin. It's the biggest thing in the book world since Hillary Clinton's Advance, a program that originated in Seattle but has since spread nationwide, in which all the residents of the city are urged to read the same book during 1 week. The program has produced controversy in several communities, and right now, New York City is in the midst of a dispute over which book to choose for the program. Today's guest says he has the solution. He's Dr. Buddy Mendoza-Marquez, and he himself has a new book just about to enter the stalls and the malls. Dr. Mendoza-Marquez, welcome to the Book Bag.
Well, thank you, Ira, but it's Dr. Marquez Mendoza.
Oops. My, as they say, bad.
Oh, it's all right. It's a nom de plume anyway.
All righty then. Doctor, you're the author of a book which has already hit the top of the Amazon chart before even being completely bound.
That's right. It's pretty amazing, isn't it? The book is called Weight Loss Secrets of the Aztecs, mm-hmm. and it offers a step-by-step process for shedding unwanted pounds that's proven by 3,000 years of Aztec experience.
Wow. Did the Aztecs, particularly among ancient peoples, suffer from weight problems?
They were very smart people. They figured out everything. We're really just catching up with them.
Well, they didn't have computers, though.
No, that's true. In that one area, we have them beat.
And just to follow this thread for a moment, mm-hmm. the Incas didn't have anything like this, or the Mayas?
My book is about the Aztecs. In future volumes, I hope to explore the idea that other ancient peoples might have weight loss wisdom to share with us.
Okay.
But those deals haven't been made yet.
All right, let's focus on this book.
Good.
You believe, according to a statement you put out this week, that it is the ideal choice to settle the currently ongoing dispute in New York City over what book everybody in that community should read during an upcoming week.
Sure. I think the whole get a city together to read one book premise is a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
And in a smaller town like a Seattle or even a Chicago, you can find some literary piece that will work in that kind of environment. But in New York, we've got too many cross currents, too many different backgrounds for just a work of literature to speak to them all, you know. But well, Ira, I can guarantee you this, based on my 11 years of practice in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to be thinner. There's your great bond, and reading my book could start the city on a great conversation about weight and weight loss and Aztecs.
What kind of practice did you have in New York?
I was a doctor type practice.
But don't you think that the whole notion of reading together involves the discussion of ideas?
Body image is an idea. Diets received through astrological projection, that's a powerhouse idea. That could fuel a whole season of X-Files. But I know what you're getting at, Ira, and I think this. You don't unite a city by dividing it. That's like setting fire to the village to burn it down. Giving everybody something to read that lets them talk about whether to attempt this plan and how, and then to compare notes on how well it's working, that, to me, makes much more sense than here's something to read that'll teach us how to be more sensitive to each other. I mean, when we're better looking and feel better about ourselves, of course we'll treat each other with more respect. That's a no-brainer.
But isn't a no-brainer a bad thing?
Ira, I live in the world of what works. A book that teaches you how a proud and powerful people had the best-looking abs in the whole BC universe, that works as a conversation starter for the city and as a two-week journey towards a body chiseled by ancient gods.
Dr. Marquez Mendoza, good luck with your proposal and your book.
Thank you.
Who knows, perhaps in the not-so-distant future, we'll have thousands of modern Aztecs walking the streets of New York City.
Well, as long as they don't get into the animal sacrifice thing, that would be great. Thanks.
Support for this podcast came from the American Bookkeepers Association. We like books, too. Next week, another glimpse of the lives tucked between the table of contents and the index. Till then, I'm Ira Zipkin, climbing out of the book bag. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
But it's time for me to cease and desist. 'Cause I'll put myself on the critical list. I've gotta stop breaking my own heart. I've gotta stop breaking my own heart. I've gotta stop breaking my own heart.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's talk about lobbying, shall we? Here's a lobby that works pretty well. According to the Chicago Tribune, federal regulators repeatedly backed away from tougher measures for airline security after the airlines complained of higher costs and the impact on their on-time performance. The FAA claims one congressman was artfully manipulated by airline industry lobbyists. The lobby includes the wife of Tom Daschle. That's right. Senator Tom Daschle. Officials at the FAA defend their track record. The administrator of any federal agency has to, by law, take into consideration the opinions of the industry it regulates. Yeah. And the cops have to take into our consideration the opinions of the people they ticket? What? How did that not work? The Air Transport Association of America denies it has fought proposed security improvements, but a 1996 study commissioned to examine problems with checkpoint screening at Chicago's O'Hare Airport reported a far different outlook from the airlines. The airline stated without exception that pre-board passenger screening is not a priority, according to the report, which interviewed O'Hare Airline executives as part of its study. In their words, there is no value added in higher levels of security. So let's bail them out. Now, we'll talk about other lobbies in a minute. No, let's talk about it now. How about the campaign finance reform bill? That's a good thing, isn't it? Well, not as good as it used to be. The this from Multichannel News, a trade publication. Should I be? Nah, I don't have the trade music here. The cable and broadcast television industries dodged a potentially costly bullet this week as the House of Representatives stripped a campaign financing bill of a provision that would have required television stations to offer candidates for federal office the lowest rate that they charge for advertising. This is an old regulation that was allowed to lapse under intense lobbying pressure by the broadcast industry. The House approved the amendment offered by Representative Gene Green of Texas that strips the amendment took out the what am I trying to say here? TV stations used to be required to sell commercial time to politicians at the lowest possible rate that they sell to anybody. And this stripped that provision out of the campaign finance reform bill. It was authored by Robert Torricelli. It mandates that TV stations offer candidates the lowest charge for a specific time slot over the preceding 180 days. It also would have prohibited stations from bumping candidates' commercials when other advertisers offer to pay more. Cable and broadcasting groups lobbied furiously against the provision in the House, fearing it would cost them money and it would lead to a proliferation of political ads at the expense of normal commercials. Well, we don't want that. We would not want that, would we? How would we know what beer to buy? Between 1980 and 2000, an analysis by a nonpartisan group showed the amount spent on political ads in major market TV stations more than quadrupled. Broadcasters found a way around the provision anyway, even when it was still in the law, because they could charge higher rates to guarantee that their spots would not be preempted from placement on popular primetime programs or adjacent to local news shows. The average cost of a 30-second TV spot tripled from the end of August 2000 to the end of October last year. In a just-completed survey of 146 countries' campaign finance systems, Michael Pinto Dushinsky of Britain reported what is exceptional about America is it's not having free broadcasting granted to candidates and parties. That's what's exciting. It's not our great pizza. Other news of show business, ladies and gentlemen? Sure. A boy band singer, a Hollywood leading man, and a blockbuster movie director are queuing up for the ultimate in reality television. They've put their names down for a journey into space. I know there are a lot of people in Los Angeles who would like to fire James Cameron into space, but he's one of them. Details emerged with the announcement the Russian space company Mir Corp expects to sign up Lance Bass, singer from NSYNC, as the first celebrity cosmonaut to live on board Space Station Alpha. It will cost Mr. Bass's backers about $25 million. His heavily sponsored mission will be recorded for a TV special, Celebrity Mission, Lance Bass. Other globally known stars are keen to follow, including James Cameron, the director of Titanic. He can be king of space. And Tom Cruise, who would weigh even less in space. It's electric, this concept, says, what is this guy's? David Creek, the president of Destiny Productions. It attracts attention faster than any other. It seems that the way to go here is celebrities in space. I have some nominees, but heck. And, ladies and gentlemen, finally about show business, before we get into something serious like religion. You probably noticed that the pictures from the Olympics are pretty darn good, even though they're digital. They're digitally delivered to NBC stations. And I was wondering about that myself, because I've been railing here about how bad the basketball games on NBC look when they're digitally fed, and I figured it out. When you're into the digital wonderland, they can control, engineers can, the bit rate at which the stuff is compressed and sent. So if they want to cheese out, they can send it at a lower bit rate. If they want to show off, they can plunge for a higher bit rate. You know this if you've ever made an MP3 on your computer. You have a choice of slower and better, or faster and ugh. So that's what they're doing to show off at the Olympics. They up the bit rate, I believe. I don't know this for a fact, but I'm just sort of... But for a fact, 200,000 folks in San Francisco without cable TV cannot see the Olympics. It's because NBC moved its affiliation from its longtime affiliate, Channel 4, to a San Jose-based Channel 11. Although the move was planned for a year and a half, NBC never bothered to move Channel 11's transmitter, which is located to serve Monterey County, to a location that would better serve the Bay Area. If you don't have cable, odds are you don't have NBC and you don't have the Olympics. Says Broadcasting and Cable magazine, here's a little preview of life with digital TV. Viewers who desperately wanted to watch the Olympics in San Francisco had to climb on their roofs and move their antennas around to try to tune in Channel 11. When they do, they lose all of their San Francisco stations. All right, so much for that. Pat Robertson, who is the perfect segue between television and religion, describes Islam as a violent religion bent on world domination. Yeah, well, thanks, Pat. Pope John Paul has performed three exorcisms. It became known this week, including one as recently as September, according to one of the Catholic Church's leading exorcists. Father Gabriele Amorth said the Pope had carried out his first exorcism in 1982. This girl was rolling around on the ground. It's always a girl, isn't it? People in the Vatican had never seen anything like it. For us exorcists, it is run-of-the-mill, Amorth said. The Pope has since taken part in two more exorcisms, including a 20-year-old woman. It's always a girl. To underline the importance of the ceremony, he carried out these exorcisms because he wanted to give a powerful example. He wanted to give the message that we must once again start exorcising those who are possessed by demons, says Amorth. I have seen many strange things, he added. The devil told a woman he would make her spit out a transistor radio, and lo and behold, she started spitting out bits and pieces of a radio transistor. Well, that's close. That's as close as Dan Rather and Dan Pearl. Amorth said the woman whom the Pope exorcised in September was still undergoing treatment. It's a very serious case, he said. One might be tempted to ask, why not conduct exorcisms of the 80 priests in the Boston Archdiocese alone who've been reported to have had pedophilic experiences with their parishioners, with their young male parishioners. Wouldn't exorcism work for them? No, only young girls. But for the woman who told a news program this week that her solution was to join the Anglican Church, attention, woman, Australian Governor General Peter Hollingsworth has resisted mounting pressure to resign, issuing a comprehensive statement defending his handling of child sex abuse allegations against Anglican priests and staff at church schools when he was the Anglican Archbishop of Brisbane. He denied he'd condoned sex between a priest and an underage girl. But he has been forced to withdraw as patron of the Kids First Foundation. Well, this, you know, this is not new, ladies and gentlemen. Back about 9 years ago when the Catholic bishops were having a meeting in America, they didn't issue so much of a statement on the problem as a song.
So good, like the scent of sweet spring flowers, kissed by April's tender showers, and I'd do the same for hours. You smell so good, you're as fresh as ocean spray, dear, or a spicy autumn day, dear, and I love you just that way, dear. Sweetheart, you smell so good, you leave me weak, I'm so breathless I can't speak, every time we're snuggled cheek to cheek. You smell so good, like a ball of circus candy, or the fine bouquet of brandy or tea. Oh, baby, you smell so good to me. Da-da-da. What's that aftershave you're wearing? Don't you think it's kind of daring? But it's really got me caring. You smell so good. How I love that aphrodisia. Makes me want to hug and squeeze ya, or do anything to please ya. Darling, you smell so good. You make me flip. Let's arrange that wedding trip. When the preacher says dig, I'll say I'm hip. Oh, 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 you smell so good, like a garden full of roses, and to think this treat for noses is free. Oh, baby, you smell so good to me.
Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, wrapping up this week's broadcast, you probably heard two concourses at New Orleans Airport were evacuated because of a suspicious package found in the men's mess room. The bomb squad found containers of gumbo. That's what I love about New Orleans. Even the bombs are gumbo. And the widows of 15 police officers killed at the World Trade Center threatened to take legal action to stop the new New York administration from transferring control of the $160 million Twin Towers Fund to a private charity run by Rudy Giuliani. So maybe he's not St. Rudy after all. And this week, as the music in the background indicates, Chuck Jones, the genius behind Warner Brothers Animation, passed away. I never met Chuck Jones, but I was privileged early on in my show business life to work with the late, great Mel Blanc, the voice of all those characters. It was the un-Disney. And Chuck Jones will be missed. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this... Ouch! That concludes this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, on the USN 440 cable system. Did I say NPR? On the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the American Forces Network, on shortwave at WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz, and around the world on your computer whenever you want it at two locations, www.harryshearer.com and www.kcrw.com. And it would be just like all the bombs being gumbo if you'd agree to join me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much, uh-huh. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. The show internet services by Steve Mack. You're invited to visit the Le Show virtual trading floor, and next time you're in Houston. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.